Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Peter Breggin, again, welcoming my wonderful audience around the world, folks from Great Britain, Canada, North America, and sometimes from more faraway places. It's a pleasure to be talking to you again today. I want to remind you that a few sessions ago, I finished a four-part series with Peter Gerze, marvelous, wonderful Peter Gerze from Denmark, who was a founder of what's called the Corcoran Collaboration, and is someone who has spent his life as an internist and a researcher, setting standards for improved research in medicine. And then when he got to looking at psychiatry, he couldn't believe it. It wasn't just bad. It was a crime, he concluded. And Peter is just a wonderful contributor to the area of mental health, psychiatry, psychopharmacology, as well as medicine in general. And we do have a four-part series of my having a conversation with him, and I was reminded of it today because my guest, Deborah Haas. Deborah, you there?
I am. I am here.
That's a good connection, too. My friend Deborah Haas, my new friend. She's not an old friend like many of my guests. She's a new friend like many of my guests. Deborah Haas listened to the whole series and of conversations, all 4 hours between me and Peter, and found it inspiring. Deborah is somebody who actually works with patients. I'm always really glad to have guests that have devoted their lives to service. And she works with people who are involved with addiction. She has done behavioral research. She can tell us more about that with dual diagnosed inpatient populations. And she and I have some interesting, I think, comments on dual diagnosis. I know she will. She really comes from a very compassionate, patient-oriented or client-oriented orientation. I'll let her tell you more about where she works. I'm not sure that she wants to identify it or not, so I'll let her tell you about that. But she's currently working for a board that sets standards for addiction treatment. And she just comes from a really good set of therapeutic values. She may tell you how she got involved. Deborah, hi. Where
hi.
Would you like to begin? First of all, would you like to add anything to your bio?
Well, I just wanted to correct one thing. The board that I work for set standards for the professionals that work with folks who have drug and alcohol problems. So folks that are suffering with drug and alcohol problems who need counseling, we set the minimum standards for their certification to be able to work with the folks that are in treatment.
Oh, well, that's even more interesting to me.
Which
because
means
you're
that
actually
our,
setting this.
Our work really is consumer based. We are entirely focused on ensuring that the consumer has, the individual that needs the counseling has folks working with them that are appropriately trained.
Well, let's just go right into that, because that's very, very interesting to me. This whole issue of training people, what are good standards for people who deliver services?
Yeah.
I'm going to actually be doing some work in that arena of trying to look at what are the standards, what people need as the most basic stuff for being therapists. So tell us some about those kind of standards. What are they? What do you think good standards are? What does your board think good standards are?
Well, a lot of it really has to do with them having enough education that is alcohol and drug addiction specific, as well as having time on the job. So it cannot just be that they went and took a bunch of courses and then began working with folks in treatment facilities. We want them to both have the applied work as well as the education. So that, I think, is a good place to start when folks are breaking into the field. And it is a field that is difficult because it's, you know, there may be some successes, but there are a lot of failures when people are trying to get clean from being on alcohol or drug addicted or both. And I think that it is a field that brings in some really amazing people with really big hearts, and I think oftentimes they are sadly feel thwarted in the work that they're trying to do because it's a difficult job.
How much formal education is required?
Well, for the bachelor's, there is a bachelor's level counselor certification, and that one requires that you have a bachelor's in some sort of behavioral health practice, and then you have to, within that, the certification also requires, looking it up right now because I don't know it off the top of my head, hang on one second.
But it requires some experience, is what
you're
saying.
You must have had, including the education, you must have had work experience.
So you don't necessarily need to be trained in addiction. You could have just an undergraduate degree in psychology or social work, and then get on the job training?
Well, no. The way that it works is, in order for you to get the certification, you have to have 2 years of employment as an alcohol and drug counselor.
Okay.
You have to have a bachelor's degree. And within the hours of education, there have got to be at least 100 hours that are alcohol and drug specific.
I gotcha. Now, this certification that you give, that is then something that is used by institutions?
Yeah, by treatment providers, in state agencies, depending on the state you work in, sometimes it's mandated by the state that you have the certification. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes, but certainly it is considered something that you should be working towards if you are working in treatment.
I gotcha. Now, would any of these people go into private practice?
Yeah, because oftentimes they're multiply credentialed, so they also may have, sometimes they have our certification and they also have a PhD or they have a master's or they are a licensed social worker or a licensed practical counselor or, so there are absolutely, they can be doing their own thing.
But they would need that. They couldn't just set themselves up as, well, we are certified alcohol addiction counselors, certified addiction counselors.
They could not call themselves a certified addiction counselor without the certification.
Is your certification enough for somebody to get it and go into private practice, or do they have to have other things like being a clinical social worker?
Well, in the state of Pennsylvania, I think you could, in fact, have some sort of social work requirement as well, but it would probably be professional counselor. But I would have to say that overall, I think it's pretty much that in the state, there are lots of folks that do call themselves counselors and do work with folks with addiction problems, and they don't have any other credential.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm in favor of, really trying to develop programs that actually teach people to do what they're going to do rather than necessarily even getting a bachelor's degree. I'm working with a group now to try to set up a certificate that would simply say you've been certified, that you've done the following, taken these courses and had this experience. And mm-hmm. It doesn't fit into any state licensure or anything else, but you can use this as you choose to, and as legal in your state.
Well, if you look at some of the work that has been done with peers,
yes.
There's really some significant work and good work that has been done with peer counseling.
Yes.
And there is no need necessarily for, a degree in order to be able to do the kind of work necessary to move somebody from a place of distress to a place of wholeness and health. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. I think we've got to move in that direction. More and more, we need to get folks out from under this awful system.
I agree. I agree 100%. I do. I think that when you look at the areas of where so-called experts have created an environment where folks simply cannot trust that they're getting the best care anymore from these experts that have all of the degrees, that have all of the letters after their names, but they simply are not working to get these folks who are in distress to a place of health and wholeness. That is not their goal. That is not what their aim is.
Do you yourself do any clinical work now, or have you in the past?
I have done clinical work in the past. I've worked with, both adults and with children, and I can tell you one of the areas that I am, that your work spoke to me a lot, was I worked with folks who, young kids and families, with children who had autism or other developmental disabilities. And I am now watching that population being given antipsychotics as a matter of course. And many of these families are already in extreme distress, and then you have these children who are being put on antipsychotics, and then they have self-injurious behaviors to begin with. And I am certain that the antipsychotics are creating even further difficulties with those children and with those families. So it's a pretty scary set of circumstances right now for them.
Yeah, I mean, poisoning helpless children is one of the things that most disturbs me in the whole world.
Yes.
I mean, the drugs, particularly the antipsychotic drugs, are serious neurotoxins.
Yes.
I've been spending some research time looking more into something I've written about before, but getting into it in more depth, which is how these drugs developed. And there was when they first were developed in 1952 in Europe, it was immediately recognized that they were causing all kinds of neurological problems and that they were neurotoxic. And there were lots of papers being written within the first couple of years about how they cause Parkinsonism and how they cause tremors and how they cause these strange movements, and they made some people more depressed. And there's just much more recognition those first few years on relatively low doses of Thorazine, relatively low, below our current maximums for sure. And then in 1955, the pioneers, DeLay and Denneker, it's actually 1956, for the first time, they saw people who were supposedly normal volunteers get the drugs, which were soldiers who were on shipboard getting these drugs in relatively small doses for nausea. So when they started to develop all these weird things, they couldn't call it hysteria anymore. Because these were men, they didn't have wombs, they weren't women, they had nothing that was abnormal, they were healthy soldiers, and they had to confront that these drugs were really, this is 56, this is after drugs have been in use for 3-4 years and are widely dispersed around the world, and they realized that the drugs were actually mimicking what they thought was a viral disorder. We still don't know the cause, but an epidemic of encephalitis called lethargic encephalitis. So they published a paper. They published a paper about this, Deborah. And instead of everybody saying, "Well, we don't want to give chemical lethargic encephalitis to tens of millions of people like we are, we better cut back on these drugs," they just thought it was really, really interesting, and they did research on the comparing. How identical the chemical encephalitis was to the lethargic encephalitis epidemic. But that didn't go along very well with the newer claims then that were made, PR claims that they were antipsychotic drugs. So the whole literature was buried. Nobody talked about it anymore. And probably your average psychiatrist now, finishing training, has no idea that the antipsychotic drugs cause a chemical version of epidemic encephalitis.
Right.
It's just so bad. It's hard to imagine it being any worse.
I don't want to even think it could get worse than it is already.
We're going to be doing more and more children who are defenseless and can't resist.
Now in addictions, medication assisted treatment has become sort of the new buzzword in the past several years. And so for a man-made, doctor-made, big pharma-made problem of opioid addiction, that was drawn entirely from the overprescription of opioids. We now are coming up. They now have created all of the bunch of drug companies and are now coming up with a solution to that problem with buprenorphine and Suboxone. And lots of them have been around for years and years and have not been particularly good at doing what they're supposed to do. And I think the research is not in on the newer ones, although I think the Cochrane collaboration did some looking into naltrexone and found that it was not particularly effective. But again, this is sort of where the focus now is in a lot of treatment providers to get folks off of drugs and alcohol.
So the whole big push is get them off of their chosen drugs, which we don't get any money for, and get them on our drugs.
Exactly.
It's really
many
awful.
Of these drugs are drugs they're going to be on for a very long time, and getting off of them will be dreadful. It's a circular issue with no resolution, or it certainly seems like the resolution is not going to be easy in coming.
Yeah, the whole situation is just so bizarre right now. talk some about your sense of what goes on with people who are addicted to a substance, whether there's any differences among people, whether they're addicted to alcohol or marijuana, if you think that's addictive. Be interested in your thoughts on that. I think it is. You know, whether it's opiates or marijuana or alcohol or you know, benzos. Do you see much difference between the people who get or stimulants, the people who get involved with different drugs? And do you think there's a profile? Do you think there's some underlying psychological aspect? What are you, just your general thoughts about that?
Well, I think it really depends on the individual. And I think that it is, I think it would be easy to say that there's a profile. And I don't think it's that easy. I think that what my experience has shown me, and I myself am a person in recovery from drug addiction. I've been sober for 28 years, so it's a long way down the road for me, but I have some memory of what it was like for myself, and I can tell you that I myself came from a good family, and I think that I had a lot of relative support. I had probably some level of trauma in my family because I think, you know, families suffer those things together. But I wouldn't say that I had a whole host of things that pushed me towards alcohol and drugs. I will tell you that at the time that I got started in drugs and alcohol, it was in the 70s, and it was very popular. It was in movies and television and music, and the culture was sort of touting mind expansion and things of that nature. So I think there were a host of things that landed me there. Plus, I was a young person when I started. I was very young. I was 12.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
So I was a very young person, and I must tell you, when you're young and you're in the development of your life, and you're not really comfortable, you're also in the beginning of your adolescence, when you're not even very comfortable in your own skin, when you take a drug and you feel suddenly comfortable, it becomes very appealing.
Yes.
So that is my experience, my personal experience. As I know, as I've worked with folks with drug and alcohol problems over the years, I can say there are certainly folks that I think are more prone potentially to become drug addicted. But I also know in the same family, a person, same family, got drug addicted, another person did not. So I don't feel real confident about the idea that there's this type of person that is likely to become addicted. I think if you are suffering and if it's available, it's an easy answer to potentially a fairly complex problem. And
yeah,
the earlier
I like the way you approach it. And I think if you think about a 12-year-old, I mean, so much involves chance for that 12-year-old.
Exactly.
And once the 12-year-old is on the drugs, secretly from the family, and usually that creates a lot of suspicion, distrust, paranoia in the youngster. Once the youngster's on the drugs, then the whole life changes regardless of what the parents are doing.
Right. But again, you know, I had aunts and uncles that, you know, were engaged in, you know, pot smoking and what have you. It was very popular at the time. I don't think it had the level of stigma, for lack of a better word, that it currently sort of holds. At the time, I think it was a very popular, hip thing to do.
Yeah. What do you think about it now?
Well, I don't do any drugs. So, and part of the reason that I think I've been able to be so engaged and enraged by the information I have read, you know, your research and your books and Robert Whitaker's research and books and the Cochrane Collaboration's research and books, is that I got sober in an environment where the idea was you don't use, you know, you just don't. You just stop. And there was something really clear about that sentiment to me. And there was something really positive about that sentiment to me. And it was also something I could do with the support of other people without having to engage a doctor or a counselor or, I mean, I could do those things, but I didn't have to. And I think the treatment world has become sort of usurped by dual diagnosis and psychiatry and a much more complex way of addressing addiction that is much less clear and focuses more on the individual as broken and potentially the rest of their lives will be spent trying to be fixed.
Well, that's very, very important what you're saying. Say more about that, about what that does to a human being to be told they're broken, to feel they're broken. What does that do to a person? What do you see happening?
I think when the narrative is that you are broken and the narrative is that you are a victim of, you know, the drug, the diagnosis, the whatever it is, your depression, you become the depression rather than being a person who is dealing with a little depression. It's a different way of approaching things. And I think if that becomes your identity, which I think a lot of times can happen when you're in treatment too long, you fail to recognize that, in fact, whatever the situation, just as I became an addicted person when I was 12 years old, that was not my goal. If somebody told me that that was the rest of my life and I was going to be working from that premise for the rest of my life, I was broken, I was that broken person for the rest of my life, the chances of my feeling that I had the freedom to be fixed may never have happened. I think I might have just fallen into a treatment hole and been forever, you know, moving from expert to expert and not finding my way through that situation. I think it is really important that people understand that they have the freedom and the ability to access the best parts of themselves at any point.
I love that. I love that. And it's, I wish you were still doing a lot of clinical work. I think you would be helping a lot of people with those concepts. Maybe you get to do it through your other work. But I just think that the way you talk about these things is the way good therapists think about them. And it's the opposite, as you're saying. It's really the opposite of psychiatry. And a lot of modern psychology and social work that is just hanging on to the coattails of psychiatry and medicine.
Well, the neurobiology focus at this point has become so pervasive. And I don't actually think, by and large, folks really understand what they're talking about when they talk about it. You know, they don't really understand what you're telling a person. You're telling them that they're broken. They're broken in their brains. Their minds and bodies are, you know, in some way need to be fixed by some outward drug or treatment or something that, but they're broken. And that is an awful message to tell anyone who is attempting to be a whole and healthy human being.
Well, if you know, if you were taken to a child psychiatrist today, you would at the age of 12, you would have been told that you know that maybe you had a broken brakes, that there was something that didn't allow you to resist the medication, and it was a biochemical imbalance, and we have drugs for that. How old were you when you went drug free?
I was 24.
So you went from 12 to 24.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time, 12 years, and you're a young person.
Yeah.
Did you have some kind of help? And did anybody offer you a better drug and tell you, oh, we have better drugs for you, antidepressants and so on?
You know what? I think I was really fortunate. I never. I had a seizure disorder when I was a kid, and I was on phenobarbital. Every night I had to take it. And I am a real rebellious spirit in general, I think. And I never wanted to take the drug that I had to take. So even though I had to take the phenobarb, I never wanted to take it. And then on other occasions where people have told me that I had to take certain kinds of prescription drugs, I have always been really resistant to them. I'm not entirely sure why. But therefore, I refuse to take it.
So you did get some pressure to take
medications.
Oh
my
God!
Well, it's really difficult not to I mean, in the environment we live in, it's. I went recently to just my general practitioner for a regular doctor visit, and I just happened to mention to her that I was having, some mood issues that I think are related to the fact that I'm in my 50s and there are hormonal changes happening. And she just very blithely said, well, there's some medication I could give you for that. I was like, but wait a minute. She was asking me what my symptoms were. I just told her some of the stuff that was going on with me, very general conversational reporting. And she was ready to, you know, give me an antidepressant or a mood stabilizer after 5 minutes of discussion in a GP office.
Yeah, all they have to do is hear the code words.
I know.
You know?
It's frightening.
Yeah, it's a very, very bad situation. We have an epidemic of neurotoxicity involving literally hundreds of millions of people around the world. I mean, you get various estimates in this country of 80 million people on psych drugs. I mean, it might even be 100 million, and it's hundreds of millions around the world. And it's really quite, it's beyond words. I mean, I don't readily have the words to describe the size of this catastrophe, but that's what it is.
It is. And it's particularly when I think about the folks that are dealing with drug and alcohol problems and attempting to live lives without them. And they're being told, okay, you cannot have your crack or your heroin or your alcohol or what have you. But we have got for you this bipolar drug, or we have got for you this antidepressant, or we do have this antipsychotic, which will help the antidepressant work better for you. And then on top of that, the idea that folks who are dealing with getting off of drug and alcohol, illicit drug and alcohol or addiction problems, are then maybe being told that they are disabled and then going on disability, the absolute worst possible thing for someone who is trying to change their lives and not be addicted to substances is to have 24 hours a day to think about themselves and to have no purpose. It is absolutely deadly.
100% agreement. It's so interesting to talk to you, someone I've never met, and to just find this tremendous general agreement coming from very kind of very different backgrounds and experiences. Are most of the people who are getting certified like you in that they have background experience being addicted to something?
I would say that probably a fairly large proportion of the folks that are certified have had experience with drugs and alcohol either personally or in their families.
Mm.
They've had some personal experience that has led them to this work. Because as I am certain you know, and you know, this type of work is very difficult. It is very difficult. It is low paid. It is working with folks that are very resistant to treatment often, and it takes a while often for folks to get to the place where they actually quit and have some success.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be very frustrating. I deal with it somewhat in my practice, but not a great deal. I'm mostly taking people off psychiatric drugs. This underlying idea that if you've gotten addicted to something, you have, quote, a dual diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's so funny because now we need a word for that's not dual, but like polydiagnosis.
Right.
You must have,
right.
Right. We have polydiagnosis addiction. And because we need more diagnoses to give more drugs. It would be really interesting to go back and look at who first came up with the concept of dual diagnosis. I have not researched that, but I'll bet it was some psychiatrist in the pay of a drug company.
I don't doubt that at all.
To get this huge market.
Yeah, I don't doubt that at all. Well, and the reality is you know, when I worked in the psychiatric hospital, we worked with the folks on the locked ward. We were doing a new treatment with them. But one of the things that I noticed, and this was at a hospital in a fairly poor area of the city. There were a number of folks that were schizophrenic or diagnosed with schizophrenia that came there. And they brought them into the unit and they loaded them up. You know, they just dropped, I don't know how many drugs on them. They were barely, for the first couple of days, they were pretty much comatose. And then there would be the opportunity for the, you know, our counseling folks to get up in there and begin to do some work with them. But I never quite understood how these folks who were, you know, supposedly couldn't function without their medication would go, they'd be released and they'd be fine through the summer. In the spring and the summer, they'd be great. And then around Christmas time, around when it got cold out, suddenly, you know, their voices became much more problematic. And we did deal with that some in the hospital, you know, where we recognized that some of this was context. And that, you know, these folks who had both the drug problem and the, you know, hearing voices problem, were able to manage their lives fairly well until it became difficult for them to, you know, find a warm place to lay their heads. I'm not exactly sure what that means in the long term, but I know that many of them were not able to stay on the drugs. They didn't come back. They would go, they would get their drugs, they would get, you know, three hots and a cot, they'd leave, and they'd go off their medication. And I know they went off their medication because they all, when they talked about it, hated their medication. So, again, I'm not quite sure what we're trying to do when we medicate people in these ways. What are your thoughts?
I think we're feeding the pharmaceutical empire. I think all of this change is from the collaboration between the pharmaceutical empire and psychiatry that was going broke in the 70s because it, and late 60s, because it couldn't compete with social workers and psychologists and family therapists who had something to really offer people. And the offices of psychiatrists were getting empty, and a lot of them didn't even want to pay dues to the American Psychiatric Association because things were getting tight. And the Psychiatric Association, you know, it discussed it in the board minutes, which I publish in Toxic Psychiatry, the board minutes, where they just discussed that if we're going to make a go of it, we should go into partnership with the drug companies and make clear that you may be going to a nice lady social worker whom you like and likes you and is really helping you, but that you really also need to address your problem with drugs. And if, right, God forbid, you have an intense emotion, the social worker better refer you for drugs because we don't want you having intense emotions. And it is really quite that simple and quite that ugly that psychiatry just climbed on the backs of people who didn't need them at all, and became the pushers, the drug pushers,
yeah,
of the pharmaceutical industry. And that's where we are today, and the FDA is goes right along with it, trying to find drugs that you can approve for addicts to take when they're basically just substituting another addictive drug most of the time.
Most of the time, yeah. Yeah, I have a good friend who has been sort of the product of, sadly, the product of bad counseling and treatment for years. And she had a very serious trauma happen to her when she was a young person. She and I became addicts together. We were good friends, and you know,
when she was a little girl.
And nobody, mm-hmm, debated the fact that the trauma happened to her. It absolutely did happen to her, you know. And then she went to a bunch of counselors and so on and so forth, and they diagnosed her with everything that was new in the DSM. She started with, she was borderline for a while, and then she was bipolar, and then she was multiple personality, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They just, everything that sort of came along the pike, she got. And then she got every new drug, and you know, had horrible reactions to the drugs, but, you know, nobody was quite sure whether it was the drug or, you know, her mental illness or, you know, what it might have been. She would, you know, talk to me about these horrible, violent dreams she had all the time. You know, her life was essentially taken away from her for years, yeah, and years and years. And she was on cocktails of drugs when she came out of an inpatient program that the list of the paper that came out was like, you know, a quarter inch thick of all of the drugs that she was on. Buspar, et cetera, et cetera. And anti-epileptic drugs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she's one of the most brilliant people I know. And I recently, in the past several years, had her read Anatomy of an Epidemic. And she began to read it, and she was so disturbed by it that she couldn't continue to read it. She got the general idea. She talked to her psychiatrist, and they're working on getting her off of her antipsychotic, one of several drugs that she's on. And I have seen just from the mind, because she was so over-medicated on the antipsychotic that I didn't even recognize the person that she was anymore, and I've known her since I was a child. Just from reducing the amount that she's on, I see my friend. She has reemerged. I think she has a lot more work to do, and I think it's going to be very difficult. But in this whole thing, you know, she began using drugs again at one point because, you know, at some point you just, why even be sober? You're on so many other drugs. What's the point? You know, so her whole life has been upended by psychiatry and psychology, and she's beginning to turn it around, but not because it's easy. And I find it amazing that not only was she actually a victim of, you know, some true trauma when she was a child that she needed actual help with, but then subsequent to that, she's been victimized deliberately by psychology and psychiatry, and not for any reason other than she was trying to get some help with this one thing that happened to her. And it's been her whole life since she was 14, and she's in her 50s now. So
the drugs lock us into place, whether you're taking street drugs, alcohol,
absolutely,
or psychiatric drugs.
Absolutely.
You start taking them as a child, and a part of you doesn't grow up.
Right. Right. But that's all they had to offer. You know, that's all they had to offer her. They didn't offer her, you know, a kind, you know, voice of someone that could help her work through some of these issues that just needed to be dealt with.
Yeah.
So it's complicated. And that is an example of the dual diagnosis that I'm talking about. Like, she went from being a person dealing with drug and alcohol problem to a person who has been locked into these other diagnoses for the balance of her life.
Yeah, she went from a consumer of one kind of drug to a consumer of the products of the pharmaceutical empire. It's just such a dreadful circumstance.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about how, after 12 years on various drugs, how you got free?
Oh, okay. Well, there were, I think, a couple of things at play. First off, this cannot be minimized. I had a good family who I think were ready for me at any point to pull myself together. So when I went to AA, I very simply just went to AA. And my family then supported me in being a person that didn't do drugs anymore. And I think that is the piece that's missing for a lot of folks who do not have the family backing that I had. I had as I said before, a really wonderfully supportive family. And then I just simply went to AA and hung out with a lot of other people who were attempting to do the same thing that I was doing, which is just stay sober. And that's how I've maintained it.
Do you still have a relationship with AA?
Yeah, I'm not as close to it as I once was, but yes.
Well, good, good. I'm really glad we got into that. In this credentialing process that you're involved in, is AA an issue at all? Is there any interest in suggesting to people or that they know about AA? Or
yes, within the treatment community, AA is still something. Yeah, AA and the various other anonymous programs are still used. There is a, I would say, concerted effort to dismantle their utility in the public mind in the past several years, as we sort of focus more on medication-assisted treatment and evidence-based practices. And I really am holding my fingers up in sort of quotation marks when I say evidence-based practices.
All that actually means is drug companies-sponsored clinical trials.
Exactly, exactly.
It doesn't mean anything other than that.
Exactly. And one of the things that I have been doing, because one of my jobs at what I do is I help to prepare and get trainings out to our professionals that I think that they need. And my focus has been on critically analyzing the evidence base. So I work with trainers to look at the evidence base and what the evidence base actually is comprised of. And for folks who don't have my background, and I do have a background in science, so I know how to read data, and I know how to read these really bad studies with really short clinical trials of 30, clinical trials of 15 that they follow up for a month or maybe 90 days if you're lucky. It is good to have someone help people who don't have that background digest that information. That has been central to what I have been trying to do over the past year or so, is to ensure that information, like the information you have, Dr. Bregan, and Robert Whitaker, and all of the other wonderful places that are doing this courageous work, it needs to be disseminated more widely. And although I have a very small sphere of influence, I'm doing what I can to make sure that it gets out to our professionals.
Now, you're doing that on your own, or do you get a chance to do it through your work?
I do it through my work. I am the director of education and training where I work.
Oh, that's great.
So we create, I work with trainers to create certain kind of content, and I have to tell you, some trainers are more willing than others to disseminate this information because it's not necessarily well accepted. I can also, though, say that there were a couple that we did last year that were so well received. I was so impressed. People want to hear it. They just aren't hearing it most of the time. So when they finally hear it, it's like, aha, that's why it's not working.
That's wonderful. Do you want to tell folks about your conference? Is that open to the public or just professionals? I just saw the notice of your conference.
Oh, well, we have a conference for folks in the field or folks that are interested in the work that we do with drugs and alcohol. That is going to be happening in May. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It is obviously open to a lot of folks. Mostly it does cater to professionals who have a focus on drug and alcohol counseling.
But anybody who's interested could come.
Absolutely.
And how do they find out about your conference in Lancaster?
They can go to our website, which is www.pacertmore.com. www.tabletopboard.org.
www.tacertboard?
Yes, .org.
So T-A-C-E-R-T.
No, P-A as in Pennsylvania, P-A.
Oh, okay.
Cert, C-E-R-T-B-O-A-R-D.org.
P-A-Certboard.org.
Yes. Yes.
Well, it sounds like you're doing really good stuff. It's a pleasure to meet you, folks. This was, we're talking with, and we're going to be finishing in a minute or two, with Deborah Haas, H-A-A-S. She's got a master's in education, but her experience goes far beyond that, and her knowledge and her training and training of other people. And this is Deborah's first radio show. And I get a kick out of that. Ginger finds interesting, worthwhile people. And it's really, I really enjoy having folks come on who've never been on the radio before and having very interesting conversation about, you know, what's real life out there in the professional community. And I'm sure you're a breath of fresh air wherever you go in this community. And I'm sure so many people are so glad to hear what you're saying. Am I right about that?
Thank you so much.
But am I right about it?
I hope so. I hope so.
I'm sure of it. So again, Deborah Haas, H-A-S-S. And thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.